Welcome to another edition, the November 2010 edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. Today we can welcome back Laurie Harrison after an almost 7 month absence, and I want to thank Janet Balser for being her replacement all this time. And also, Janet will come back once in a while. She is not totally gone. But today, Laurie and I are interviewing Barbara Nason. Barbara Nason has lived on island for quite a while. And I think that Laurie said she's practically an old-timer.
And of course, that's something that I would deny outright, because I did arrive in the islands in the early 70s, but to me, to be an old islander, your family has to have been here long before that. You know, in the hard times, in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, when the island was a hard scrabble place to live and it wasn't a tourist trap of any kind, I arrived in the early 70s, so regardless of how many generations of my family have lived here now, I don't think of myself as an old islander.
That's an old-timer. Where did you come from?
Well, I was living in Southern California. I graduated high school there, and I went to the University of California at Riverside. And I sort of lost steam at the university, but had a part-time job working at the largest motorcycle shop in Riverside, California, in the parts department. And I found that job really enjoyable. My boss, who was the parts manager, fell in love with my work ethic, because I actually liked to work. When I'm working on someone else's dime, I don't want to sit around. And so I always found something to do, which was a shock to him that the employee would do that. So he liked me a lot. I found that job more interesting than my schoolwork, and so eventually I dropped out of school and was working more full-time there. I was sort of the de facto assistant part manager. But I was restless, and one day I kind of came to the conclusion that I needed to flee and see the world a little bit, but not being an international traveler like everyone is now. My vision was to get a Volkswagen bus, which I found. It was a stick shift, so I had to learn how to drive a stick shift. Found this bus and took off on an indefinite trip with an indefinite destination of back east, where we had lived when I was younger. My dad proclaimed this car a death trap, but he let me go.
So, Barbara, this is the end of the 60s. I mean, let's put it in context here. It sounds so crazy to think about it now, but yeah, Volkswagen van, and this is the, you know.
Well, it was just a method of transportation. You could sleep in it. They didn't make camper vans then, but it was usable as a camper.
Okay.
It had a platform in the back over the engine where you could, for the bed. And you know, it was very nice. I took off. It was the summer of 69. Well, no. Probably the summer of 70. Yeah, it would be the summer of 70.
Okay.
And drove up on the backside, down through the Imperial Valley, and stopped at the backside of Yosemite Park.
Mm-hmm.
And, did some camping there and sort of worked my way up through Mount Shasta and Crater Lake and Mount Rainier.
And it didn't bother you to be the only driver?
No, I didn't travel long distances.
No.
I stopped where I felt like it. And
would you say you were a hippie chick?
Well, I didn't think of myself as one, but probably from the outside it might look that way. In fact, when I was young, I had long, straight, blonde hair, and I often had to tell people that I didn't dye my hair blonde in order to appear to be a blonde. I just happened to be born that way, and so they shouldn't take it too seriously, because in those days, being a long blonde hair for some people was like flies to honey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It sent a message.
It did, and that wasn't necessarily the message that I wanted them to get, but
right,
whatever. So when I was at Mount Rainier, people there told me that I really had to go up to the North Cascades National Park, which was new then. They completed the North Cascades Highway and opened the park about the same time, probably the year before. So it was 1970. Mm-hmm. And by the time I'd gotten to that part of my trip, I was already thinking about going back to school because, I guess I'm not as much of a traveler as one might think. I really enjoyed the green world of Oregon and Washington. Mm-hmm. I discovered when I went through Seattle that the University of Washington didn't like students to transfer in until they had all of their credits to be a junior. And so I was thinking about where I might be able to deal with that. And the first place I stopped in the vicinity of North Cascades, up along the highway, the people in the campsite next to me actually lived right next door to Skagit Valley College in Mount Vernon and said, it's a great college and you might want to check it out.
Wow.
I spent the summer hiking and camping in the North Cascades and fairly early on registered to go to Skagit Valley College in the fall.
Now, when you were in the North Cascades and exploring up there, did you see anything that you want to remember back from?
Oh, well, I was very fortunate. I teamed up with the summer park ranger at Cascade Pass, which for people who know the North Cascades, it's a beautiful location, but kind of out of the way. And on his days off, we would go even further out of the way, and we hiked to the South Cascade Glacier and the North Cascade Glacier. There's all sorts of glaciers up there, places that you just don't get to. And I remember a little place called Kool-Aid Lake. It was stuff I could never do by myself because I'm not really a hiker or a mountaineer in any way, but it was nice to have the right people around to make that happen. And I would drive from there all the way down to Mount Vernon for supplies and showers at Rockport and mail at Marble Mount. There's two major campgrounds on the Marble Mount Road up to Cascade Pass. And during the week, they were fairly empty.
Mm-hmm. It must have been gorgeous.
Oh, it was gorgeous. It was gorgeous.
Yeah.
And I remember the sound of rain hitting the top of my Volkswagen bus. Pelting rain often, even though it was summer, because it rains a lot up there.
Sure.
So what classes did you take that fall quarter?
Well, I wanted to try and take care of things that I'd omitted at the University of California, where I was sort of doing the liberal arts stuff, the core curriculum. So I signed up for a rather challenging group of classes. I was taking calculus, physics, and psychology that first quarter. Yeah, and I found that this sort of put people off a bit, but not John.
Okay. Yeah.
Where did John come in?
Well, he was in my physics class, and so he was brave enough to start a conversation about the Pythagorean theorem after physics class one day, and so that's how we met.
Okay.
Was he about your age?
Oh no, he's about 7 years older. He'd come back to the college to take some construction technology classes. The summer before, he started building his parents, Jack and Doris's retirement home at Sea Ranch here on Lopez Island. And so meeting John meant I met Lopez Island.
Okay.
So that would have been September, let's say, of 1970. And the first time he brought me out to the island, his parents were still there. And so I met Jack and Doris almost as soon as I met John. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I made a good impression. By Thanksgiving, we were engaged, which was I thought I was a little young to get married. But as I said, John was 7 years older than me, and he was sort of at the right age to be married. I think he he would, you know, there was something he needed that stability in his life, I guess. Yeah. And so he was a cradle robber.
Cradle robber, come on, let's just put the hay down where the goats can get to it.
And an on-form cradle robber, because at that point he knew me as a California hippie girl. And I turned into a CPA. That was a bit of a...
You never know.
You never know.
Yeah,
you
when you marry know. That young, Barbara.
Yeah. But I think he was reconciled to the fact that, you know, that I was an intelligent person, and even if I didn't finish schooling right then, I probably would get around to it eventually.
Well, and that, he was in love. Let's, you know.
Oh, I hope. Yeah.
There we go.
I think that did come up. Yes, that did come up.
Okay. So when did you get married?
Well, we got engaged at Thanksgiving time. We got married in March of 71 because that was spring break. Obviously a ridiculous time to get married outside in March at Iceberg Point on Lopez Island.
Wow. Yeah.
I've never believed in expensive weddings. I never, ever have believed in it. And I actually proved that to myself, you know, at our wedding, because I actually sewed my own very hippie-ish wedding dress. I made the German chocolate cake.
Oh, my God. And who was your minister?
I don't know if many people would remember Denny Johnson, Universal Life Church. You know, it was a convenience, not a religious statement of any kind. But we knew it would be legal, and that was the main requirement.
Oh, that's right.
I was showing you guys pictures before, and we found a picture of Denny and I in the back of what might have been my Volkswagen bus signing the marriage license at Iceberg Point after the ceremony.
And he already had his lumberjack shirt on.
It's true, yes. Yeah. No, he wasn't really a suit guy either.
No, but he wore it for the service.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It was a lovely ceremony. The sun came out a little bit afterwards. Everybody was dressed very warmly because it was a blustery day. But our friends had prepared this huge feast of crab and all those things that you used to be able to get for cheap on the island, and a grand time was had by all.
And where was this reception?
Oh, well, the afternoon reception was there at Iceberg Point, but of course we convened to an indoor location after dark, and we all went to the newly opened Galley Restaurant.
Okay.
Where Edna Leidick was cooking, and we had Edna burgers. And everybody was toasting Mrs. Nason, and I kept saying, "She's over there," and pointing at Doris. And Doris would point at me and said, "No, she's over there," and would point at me.
Now, the galley was newly opened. What served as the galley beforehand?
Well, one of my first memories of Lopez, which would have been in the fall of 1970, was the building that no longer exists that was right in front, in the parking lot of where the galley is now.
Okay.
It was a sort of a railroad car shaped building that was a tavern and probably a bar.
Okay.
I don't remember what kind of licensing it had.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care back then. And that's where we announced our engagement, ringing the bell. There was a bar and chairs there, and then there was a little area with some tables and a Norwegian flag.
Oh.
Someone in your audience might remember Nils and Mary Sickstrom, who were sort of the bulwarks of that bar and of the island, and they actually came out to Iceberg Point for our wedding, and I hoped it wasn't so cold that it reduced their lifespan any, because they were probably the oldest people there.
Now, I'm just trying to imagine this, Barbara. So you've told us that you had your hand-sewn wedding dress, but you've also told us that it was very cold out on Iceberg. How did you keep from freezing to death yourself?
Well, there was the purple shawl. There were the pants on under the dress. There was the hiking boots because of the mud. So, yeah, it was very much me, but it wasn't particularly wedding. But you have to add the daffodils, garlands of daffodils, bouquets of red flowering currant because it was in season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so red flowering currant is a very big favorite at our house. So it was nice.
Oh,
it was very nice.
And I have to say, for our listeners, Barbara did bring a photograph, and Allie and I have gotten to see it, and it looks glorious with it's the garland of flowers and the smiles on your faces and the long blonde hair, and John has beard.
Yeah. Oh yeah, well, people that known us for a long time know that John had a beard I think, until 1990, when he shaved it off and was unknown to many people for for months and months. Yes, yes.
So, did you start living on Lopez then?
Yes, well, as I said, John was building Jack and Doris's retirement house, and so that following summer, when the weather improved, we worked on finishing that. We were living in the cabin that was their cabin at Sea Ranch. You know, Jack and Doris had come to the island first in the mid-50s and rented from and then bought the cabin from Louis and Dort.
In the mid-50s?
Yeah.
My, oh, my.
Yeah. And they came here because their daughter Anne was a counselor at Camp Norwestern.
Okay.
When it was Henderson Camp, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And backing up to Sea Ranch for a minute, do you have any idea, or maybe, Allie, you know, how many houses Dort and Louis, or cabins Dort and Louis had down there?
I don't know the number.
I don't know the exact number, but it was around 7 or 8, mm-hmm. all the way from what used to be the Zook's cabin, over to where the Peels live now. That was, the name escapes me.
Uh-huh.
They were sort of, I think they bought from Louis and Dort, but they weren't part of Sea Ranch for some reason. You know how property lines change. They were offered the entire resort at one point, but declined buying it and simply bought the cabin that they lived in, which is what they ended up doing. Everybody bought their cabins because, Louis and Dort were sort of getting out of the resort business. And they came up every summer, and John and Anne came up every summer, and they decided they wanted to retire here. So John started that house for them in the summer of 70, shortly before I met him. So we lived in the cabin while we finished the main house. Then we moved into the house with the cabin furniture because we had to tear down the cabin to put in the drain field. In the old days, you could have the drain field that close to the water. And then Jack and Doris moved in perhaps 6 months to a year later. I don't really recall.
Mm-hmm.
And so we needed to move out of there. And as it happened, Cliff Gallinger, who still owns one of the Sea Ranch cabins, allowed us to move into that because it worked out for him.
So basically you were living right next to your in-laws.
Yeah, but these are in-laws that I have always loved from when I met them. I think in many ways John felt the same way about my parents, though I think it was better that they were in California, not next door. And my parents and John's parents loved each other from the day they met, the day before the wedding. Mm. So it was one of those marriages last when all those things happen. Mm. You don't have those stresses of other members of the family
That's
not
right.
liking each other
mm-hmm.
too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
can you tell us about this Gallinger place that you moved into, this cabin?
Oh yeah, well it was one of the original cabins, which means it was sort of built from surplus materials from World War II. And Louis and Dort, I think, built them mostly themselves. And I assume that Cliff did some work on it, but I have no memory of that.
So did you pay rent there?
Well, Cliff felt that we should cover his costs, which at that point was the Sea Ranch Association annual dues, which was $30 a year. So we agreed.
Oh, times have changed.
Yes, yes. Well, and costs have changed.
Yeah.
And it was a nice, funky little cabin. We had ducks and geese.
Okay.
But it had its weak points. We got a cat, but that didn't seem to help. We would have mice that would run around on the ceiling boards above the bed and wake you up at night. Thump, thump, thump. And then when we got the cat, occasionally the cat would get up there and then you could have crash, thump, thump, thump. And of course, we didn't like it in the... I think it was in the spring or the fall when you'd end up with slugs in the silverware drawer because the walls were kind of not really tight.
Ay, ay, ay.
But, it was comfortable. It was comfortable.
Did you ever get any good storms out that way?
Oh. When we were living in the house before it was finished, it was must have been the January, February of 71, we had a massive nor'easter. And your listeners must know what nor'easters are. If they don't, they will, because they come around, not often, but they come around. And it was a massive storm with winds over 100 miles an hour, and the house faced directly into the northeast. We had no carpets and no curtains and an unfinished basement that didn't have windows. So keeping, I think with the electric baseboard heat and the fireplace going, we could keep the temperature at about 55. Yeah. And we discovered that big gusts hit about every 20 minutes, which is about the length of time you can get to falling asleep, and then you would wake up again as the house would shake because there was a cantilever deck. Yeah. So it was, and I was so impressed that I knew I was going to live here always, because storms like that, as long as they don't come every year and become awful, they humble you and they remind you that nature works. And no, I've always loved Northeasters in theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, also, it sounds like you've loved them in actuality from time to time.
Oh, yes, huddling in the cold and hoping the trees don't land on the house.
That's right.
Yeah, there's a lot of trees coming down. The worst situation is when it's been raining before the cold comes and the roots get frozen out of the ground and then the winds come and they fall down.
Yeah, I remember it was in the mid-90s, I think, there was just one of those where it was just pickup sticks, the trees everywhere.
Well, in fact, I think what you're remembering is the storm where there was two Northeasters in a row.
Tell us about that one.
Well, that would have been around 90 or 91 because Andrew got potty trained. Everyone else was pooping in a bucket, so he learned how to. Everybody's pipes froze on the island, you know, no matter where you were. You know, I mean, the power was out for days. You know.
Oh, my God.
And we had two in a row. It was awe-inspiring, and we're all thankful that so much of our power is underground, and that's why.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And it's the Northeasters that caused Opalco back in the 50s to decide to underground the residential power.
Oh, yeah. Is that right?
And we're really grateful that they did.
Yeah. Allie, you must have been here through some pretty big storms.
Oh yeah.
And you're facing fairly northeast here.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. No, that was definitely. Memories of big Northeasters.
And of course, living in a cabin that costs us $30 a year, we couldn't really move anywhere else. Yeah. But we were able to find a piece of land to buy. Okay. And we made an offer on it, and immediately the woman who was selling decided that she wanted to sell more of the same parcel. Ona Jean Goodrow was our realtor. So suddenly, instead of coming up with $12,000 or the down payment on $12,000, we had to come up with a down payment on a $16,000. It was $1,000 an acre back then.
$1,000 an acre.
Yeah, well, didn't have waterfront, didn't have a view, was wooded. But it was very close to Lopez Village, which in retrospect, I was very glad that happened. It's a nice, quiet corner. So when suddenly we had to come up with about twice as much money as we'd planned for the down payment, we, besides getting a bank loan for part of it, we actually hawked the stereo.
Now, you probably had to go to the mainland to do that, didn't you?
I don't remember. I'm sure that's something I delegated to John, but we definitely did.
Hawked the stereo for the down payment on your land. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, we worked hard from then on to pay that down, and we early on put in a well. We had Bud Thompson come over and drill a well. But but we really couldn't do much more with the property except to make the payments, because since we insisted on living on Lopez in a time when the practical thing to do is to live on the mainland, make money, and then retire to Lopez or move to Lopez later, we wanted to live here, which we found the islands too early. So we knew that was the case, and so we knew we were just going to have to find a way to make it work. One of the ways we found to make it work, well, it was that I had some part-time jobs. I wasn't really seriously working. John was working full-time. In those days, actually, you weren't required to work if you were the spouse.
Right.
It wasn't assumed that you would work. But I like to keep busy. And the first job I had was working as a bookkeeper for Bob Olson, who was the owner of Lopez Sand and Gravel back in the day.
And this was about what year, Barbara?
Probably 71, 72. And so I worked for him, and then I got another job. I probably did both jobs, because you can be a bookkeeper for a small company and do other things. I got a job working for San Juan Insurance in Friday Harbor, which is now Islanders Insurance.
Okay.
And they still have an office here on Lopez part-time, which is an office actually that I share, though the ownership of the business is, you know, is much changed, and you know, they probably don't remember that I ever worked there.
But this is next to Isabel's now.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
All right.
So I started working in Friday Harbor commuting on the ferry, and then, of course, they wanted to open up a little office on Lopez, and so I did that for them. And in order to sort of keep myself busy, because insurance wasn't a real busy thing on Lopez, I also took the job of being the auto license tab seller, because in those days, everybody renewed their licenses at the same time in January.
Okay.
So rather than the system now where you get something in the mail and it's January, February, March, April, May, 12 months out of the year, it was all one time. So it was sort of a chaotic kind of thing, and mm-hmm. somebody needed to do it. I don't remember who did it before me. I assume there was someone, but I don't remember.
And was this just for Lopez drivers?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's like, what was the, maybe 800 people living on the island around then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe less drivers.
Well, I'm not sure whether there were 800 people.
Drivers.
No, it couldn't have happened.
Of course, there could have been more cars
or
less cars, because cars and drivers don't add up.
Right on, right. So
I enjoyed doing that job, but we were sort of feeling stymied with, you know, not being able to make enough money to do anything with our property besides mm-hmm. drill the well. And one day I was reading the Seattle paper and found a job for John. And actually, with John's permission, I applied for the job. So suddenly, John was headed off to Bethel, Alaska, in Bush, Alaska, to mm-hmm. teach building trades at a community college called Kuskokwim Community College. Mm-hmm. I arrived about a month later because I had to do the auto tab thing. Now, before that, he was building houses on the island, and okay. since we like to name drop on this kind of a show, he built Ken and Marty Lloyd's house, mm. and he also built David and Cindy Gugich's log cabin mm. on Dill Road.
Okay.
In fact, he was finishing that up just before he left for Alaska.
Okay.
And Alaska worked out well for us. I got a job doing bookkeeping at the college, and John worked the summer between school sessions doing construction on the college. So we ended up living on my salary and banking his salary, and were able to pay the land off and accumulate enough dollars. So in the summer of 76, we came down to build our tiny little house, which was fashioned around the floor plan of Alaska State Housing Authority house. Yeah, 24 by 24.
Okay.
We were living in a house that side, and we used that for doing our drawings, because we design all of our houses, and we build all of our houses, and we're getting too old to do that anymore.
Uh-huh.
But so in 76, we moved into a tent on the property and started building.
Okay. And did you moved into a tent. This is a pup tent? This is a...
Well, we had two tents.
Two tents.
We had a pup tent to sleep in.
Okay.
And we had a wall tent that our next door neighbors gave us that was surplus from when they built their house. It's still on our property with a plywood roof over the top. And I vividly remember the day that the phone man came to install a phone, and he was sort of standing in the woods bemused about where the phone was supposed to be, and John pointed him to the wall tent and the post in the tent. So that's where he hooked up the phone. Worked out well.
Allie, you've got a story about a telephone when you got your line here.
When we got a line here, which was in 1982, they ran out of wire. And they said, sorry, we don't have any more. And obviously, there was none other available. So the phone was put down on the grass.
Where the line ended.
And Oscar built a little box. And I have a picture when we sold our place in California, something that we had been hoping to do that summer. And when that call came, our kids took a picture of Oscar standing there right in the middle of the grass, you know, and accepting the offer for the house. So, and it was totally normal, because I said, ran out of wire? Don't they have more? No, I guess not, you know. So that was it.
Funny.
Yeah.
Gosh.
That was the way it was.
Now, these were not days of the party line on Lopez.
Oh, no. In fact...
No, not anymore.
People who have lived here on the island for a while remember when party lines were the only kind of line you could get. I mean, you almost had to be a celebrity to have any chance of getting a private line, even into the early 80s. I don't know when they finally put... Somewhere in the 80s, they rebuilt the phone system to the point where you could have private lines.
Right.
But before that, the phone company fought tooth and nail on anybody who wanted to get a private line.
Yeah. I remember our neighbors, the Smith, Laurel and Jim, and we were on the same line.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's not a problem, really, except when you have people that... Well, we had a semi-neighbor who was on our party line, and they didn't have much furniture, I guess, because they kept the phone on the floor, and they had dogs, and you'd pick up the line, and instead of hearing a dial tone, you'd hear the distant sound of dogs barking and feet shuffling because they knocked the phone off the hook again.
Oh, my gosh.
So there was a desire for a private line for many people. You know, it's a good system, a party line, but it requires everyone to do their bit.
We had a party line when I was a kid in Seattle, but I bet by 1960 that was over in Seattle. I'm pretty sure of it.
Yeah, well, it takes longer out here.
Yeah, it's still going strong out here on Lopez.
So I remember we built our house in 76.
Okay.
And one reason I remember that is because that summer was the Olympics.
Oh.
I don't recall where that summer Olympics was, the 76 Olympics. But we would go down, if we didn't go over to Jack and Doris's, we'd go down to the Rub-A-Dub Pub, which was just down the street, because that's where the fudge shop is now.
All right.
And so we built our little house. We started it in May and moved in September, complete with the walls painted.
That was quick.
And we weren't one of those people that had insulation walls.
Oh, no.
No, no. But it was a little house.
It was 24 by 24?
Yeah, 24 by 24 and, you know, built for two.
Was it an open plan?
Very open plan, yeah. In fact, there was only bookshelves between the living room and the bedroom.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's partly because we envisioned a life with just the two of us. We really weren't thinking about kids then.
Okay.
And in a way, that's good because so that was 76, and about 79, I realized that I didn't want to be the smartest underpaid bookkeeper on the planet.
Okay.
And I realized that I needed to go back to school. Mm-hmm. And John's attitude was, well, what took you so long? Mm-hmm. Because he knew he'd cradle robbed, and that I would at some point reach the point where I knew what I wanted to do with my life. And so he was very supportive. I commuted to Skagit Valley College for another quarter or so to get a few more requirements under my belt, and then I was accepted at the business school at the University of Washington.
Okay.
And, of course, the only way to do that was to move down there, because you can't commute to Seattle.
Right.
So we got an apartment within walking distance of the university, and we started the summer of 79. We moved in on the day of the annual University District Street Fair, which was a little hard for parking to move our stuff into our apartment. I went five straight quarters, and of course, being a returning student, I sort of barreled through the competition, because when you have a 18 or 19-year-old in an accounting class in the same class as 29-year-olds and war veterans and people that have come back to school because they know what they want. Mm-hmm. There is no competition.
Right.
You know, it's almost embarrassing because we had focus.
And you did
and
well
life
there.
Experience. Oh, I did.
How well did you do, Barbara?
Well, I did fine at school. Where I really excelled was a little later.
Okay.
I graduated August of 1980, and by a twist of fate that was totally unplanned, I got hired by Alan Heiko, an accounting firm in Friday Harbor, which is the only accounting firm in the county that was doing audits, which I needed in order to get the work experience to be a CPA.
Okay.
And so they give the CPA exam twice a year, and the next one was in November 1980, And so I used the time on the ferry going back and forth to study and to cram as much as I could. It's a 5-section test, and I wanted to pass all 5 sections so I wouldn't have to go back. Just going to Seattle is such a nuisance, you know. So in November of 1980, we went down for this 2.5-day test. It was going on while Ronald Reagan was being elected for the first time.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And so a couple months later, I finally got, I got 2 letters. The first letter said that I had won an Elijah Watts Sells certificate for being in the top 103 in the nation.
Congratulations.
And of course, I told my mother, you know, they give medals for the first 3 and then everybody else gets a certificate. So I could have been 4th. Not that I thought that was important, but you know, parents like to hear that kind of thing.
Oh, come on.
And then a few months later, I got another letter from the Washington Society, and then they invited me down to Seattle for an award ceremony, and they wanted to give me a medal, and I assumed it was because I got this Elijah Watts Sells Award. I didn't think I wanted to go, but then I realized I did, and I had to admit it because there was a ferry strike. So we had to hitch a ride in a plane to get to the mainland to go to Seattle for this dinner. And I get there, and I discover that they're only giving out 2 medals for 1st and 2nd in the state. And I thought, oh, and I got the gold medal.
Oh, gosh.
Something special.
Yeah, well, everybody has their few minutes of fame, and I do have a paperweight. It's really nice. You know, it's a paperweight medal, so it's useful, too.
For Lopez to having kind of a CPA,
it's pretty
special.
Yeah, well, book learning isn't always the same as street smarts, but
Did the ferry strike very often back in the day?
No, it was very rare. And I don't know if there's been another one since, but this would have been 81, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. But the ferries have changed a lot. In the old days, the biggest boat that I remember when I first started living here was the Evergreen State.
Okay.
And, of course, there was the Vashon. Mm-hmm. And you'd go back and forth in the old days. You know, when I commuted to Friday Harbor, they actually had real kitchens with real food and sort of a bar where you'd sit and watch them cook.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a regular, they'd already have your hash browns going before you got upstairs to eat.
Yeah.
It was a different world.
It was. And in a way it was a different world, and in a way it was the same. I was raised in Seattle, and I've got pictures of Mom and Dad and the 4 of us kids, and I can't be more than 4 years old, on the deck of one of these old ferries. And I wouldn't be too surprised to find out it's one of the same ferries that's running up and back. You know, I mean, it could have been the Evergreen State. These ferries were built in the 30s, I think.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they don't serve the food in the same way they did. But actually, I was shocked to see my picture on the deck of that ferry and to think that I'm probably riding the same ferry today.
A little more rusty.
Well, that's true. I have a ferry story to tell you. Back in those days, our family was going to the South Sound, not to the North Sound. We were riding a ferry out of Steilacoom to Anderson Island.
Ah.
And that ferry took 4 cars. It wasn't a Washington State ferry. It was run by the Red Ball Line, private ferry system back there. But I think it only ran twice a day. And with only 4 cars, you wanted to be in line right there in Steilacoom.
So I commuted to Friday Harbor for a couple of years, partly by ferry and partly by motorboat, and worked part-time on Lopez and then worked in Friday Harbor. But I really got burned out. So around 1985, I said, there's more to life than working in accounting, working this hard and traveling this much. Mm-hmm. And so I finally decided, I'm just going to stop. I mean, I don't have to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm not sure why I thought that at the time, but that's what I was thinking. I don't have to work. Well, John was working full-time. Well, actually, when I was working full-time in Friday Harbor, he wasn't. It made our life much simpler. He was the house husband.
All right.
And he would bring the boat back and forth, and he would take care of the meals. I'd cook on the weekends. We just sort of flipped roles for a while, and he worked on the property.
Okay. Yeah.
When I decided that I was going to stop working, that meant that he was going to have to go back to working as an electrician. And at that point, he was working for others as an electrician. But he eventually became an electrical and plumbing contractor. with a live-in accountant.
A rarity.
And of course, here I was doing this philosophical, I don't need to work, I'm going to stop working for a while. And then within a month, I was pregnant. Which was not a bad thing, and I thought it might happen.
And
but
how
it,
long had you been married then?
16 years.
16
well,
years?
Well, 15 and a half. And so immediately we worked a little faster on the plans I'd been sketching for an addition to the house, because an open floor plan with one almost bedroom wasn't going to work with a baby. So we added two bedrooms on.
Okay.
And that was almost finished when Benjamin decided to be born 6 weeks early.
Mm-hmm. And he was born off island?
He was born off island just barely. In fact, we refer to him as our farmhouse inn baby because we really should have stopped there. Instead, we got all the way to the Skagit Valley Hospital in Mount Vernon. I got up to the pregnancy area, had the baby. John was still downstairs because they wanted him to fill out the paperwork, and babies don't come that quick, Mr. Nason.
No, sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do. Ben spent a week in the hospital with jaundice, and I was wandering the halls of the hospital crying on anybody's shoulder because all my hormones were pumping and I couldn't hold my baby all the time and I wanted to go home.
Right.
I was living in a hotel.
Yeah.
But that happens when you're an islander, you know, your baby, your kid's needs come first, and if the kid has to stay at the hospital, that's where you're at.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's right.
We had to live at Jack and Doris's house for a month while John finished the house, because when your kid's born 6 weeks early, the house isn't done.
That's right.
Yeah.
Things are always...
But, you know, Jack and Doris didn't mind giving up their bedroom, because this was their first grandchild.
Oh,
right.
Yes. So were both of your boys born off-island?
Well, they should have been, of course, because I'm a believer in being near hospitals and technology, even if you're going to have a lot. I mean, I believe in natural childbirth, but I like to have all the contingencies lined up.
Mm-hmm.
So Ben was born in 87, and in 89 I discovered that Andrew was going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to be born early, but they put me to bed. So I called my parents to come up from California because I had an almost 2.5-year-old, and you know, being in bed when you have a 2.5-year-old is hard. So they came up to the island, and the doctor said, "Okay, you can get up now and walk around and have your baby." But of course, the baby didn't want to come. So we were within 2 days of my due date, which in my family is way overdue, because you know, we're always having babies a couple weeks early. And suddenly on a Friday night, I discovered that I was in labor, and he'd already crowned. And so I looked at John, and I said, "I know that feeling. The baby's crowned." And he said, "But your water hasn't broken yet." Splash. Okay, maybe we should call for a plane. And I said, "No, we're calling 911. So Andrew was born on the living room rug with four grandparents sitting on the sofa and everybody else crowding around, everybody from... Otto Kiergaard, Doug Pesnecker, Chris Elliott is his godfather, he was the paramedic, Nancy Bingham, Judy Hill, Pat Cade, I'm forgetting people, I'm sorry, but it was...
What, you got on the phone and invited all your friends?
No, it just
EMTs.
It just takes one call.
Okay.
The fire department had a representative, yeah.
Oh, no.
They were ecstatic. It was their first baby.
Oh.
They'd had a really awful call earlier in the week, and they really needed something upbeat. You know, once I got over the chagrin of not realizing I was in labor and foolishly having my baby at home, once I got past that, everything went well, and a great time was had by all.
And Chris delivered the baby.
Yep, with one glove, because the baby kit in the ambulance only had one glove.
Oh.
He said, "Well, now, should I put that on my left hand or my right hand?"
Oh, come on!
Really, really.
And it all was, these years later, Chris and Rita just retired and left the island this summer.
I know. I don't know what I'm going to do if I have another baby.
Well, you called Guinness World Book of Records.
That's true. That's true.
Oh, yeah. dear.
Great.
Now, I do want you to tell something that you mentioned in passing. The real reason that you like to live on Lopez Island.
I have two reasons.
Oh, two reasons. I missed that.
Well, one serious reason is that I really hate to parallel park. And while that reason is starting to lose credence because parallel parking is coming to the island a little bit, much as I hate to admit it. But to me, that was always a big plus. Yeah. And of course, the other thing is that I don't think of myself as a typical person. Especially not a typical girl. I was the tomboy in my family. I was the middle of three girls. And clothes have never been my thing. And wearing the appropriate dress for the appropriate occasion is a little hard for me because I'm really tone deaf. Mm-hmm. And so I've got my weekend jeans and I have my weekday jeans, and my clients accept that about me. So I've crafted a life here on the island where I work at home, I dress in the clothes that I like to wear, and to me, that's the joy of living in a small community, that people get used to you the way you are, mm-hmm. and you don't have to
pretend.
You don't have, yeah. Well, I don't pretend.
No. And no.
I tend to say what I think, often what I should think first, and people are used to me being who I am. At least the ones that know who I am. Mm-hmm. You know, you live on an island long enough, people forget who you are. You know, the people who come on new, you know, if they see you, they don't have a place for you because I haven't run into them in the world that they've created on Lopez. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's been a long time, but I can remember going to a party years ago when somebody asked me, well, how long have you lived here?
Nice.
You know, because they just hadn't met me, and so they assumed I was newer than they were. Mm-hmm. But I don't hold that against people.
Things have changed enough these days that I think some people are feeling comfortable, some of the newer people, feeling comfortable wearing fancier clothes.
That's all right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a place of acceptance, but...
Oh, yeah.
But and two pairs of jeans, the weekend jeans and the weekday jeans.
Well, I may be the only one who knows just the difference, but, you know, but I wear the older ones on the weekend. I mean,
oh,
you know, yeah. That's not that I'm
partying.
And
a clean pair for a party.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a black pair of pants and some black sneakers for special events.
Ah,
yeah, because
right.
I don't think you should wear jeans to everything. But you know, my mother used to bring me up her leftover clothes, and so my wardrobe used to be pretty good. But now that she's older and not able to do that anymore, my wardrobe is thinning out considerably, mm-hmm. and so that would explain why I'm even less fashionable than usual.
Now, I do want you to say something about an event that is just about coming up again, the Holiday Bazaar.
Yeah, I wanted to plug the Holiday Bazaar, and I wanted to talk about my memories of it, because, you know, the Holiday Bazaar, which is run by the preschool, you know, has been a fixture on this island for a very long time. I'm not sure exactly when it started, but it wasn't started by the preschool. It was started by the library. And my mother-in-law, Doris, and I think you, Allie, were both involved with the library in those days, and that's a whole other story. Doris in the library, as we all know. But when the library became a library district and started getting property tax funds to help keep the library going, they decided that they really shouldn't keep their main fundraiser, which was the Holiday Bazaar. And I don't know how it happened, but it was the preschool was chosen to take that over. And that was before my time. I didn't really know that. But when my kids started going to preschool, so Ben would have been three, so we're probably talking 1990. The first thing that happens when you're a new parent at preschool, as we all remember, is you immediately have to get a job, you know, as part of the bazaar. That first year, I ended up being the raffle chairman. I'd never done a raffle. I was totally panicked, but came up with a wonderful idea of having businesses that couldn't give stuff because they didn't sell stuff, like the realtors, to donate money for us to buy a super duper prize. And so the only prize that year was a trip to Harrison Hot Springs.
Oh my goodness.
And the island went crazy because it had never been done before. People were buying tickets right and left. We made like three times as much money as they'd ever made before in a raffle. I felt really proud. So that was, of course, most of those tickets were bought by my mother in California. But even so, the raffle did very well, yeah. And the island had a great time with that. And, of course, I didn't want to do the raffle again. You know, you have to stop after doing something well. And so for the next few years, I still had kids in preschool, and eventually, of course, I ended up doing the accounting.
Okay.
And I mention this because I'm still doing the accounting. Right. So from, let's say I started doing the accounting in 92, and now it's 2010. It's been a while. Mm. And it's nice to have someone who's done it many years, because the preschool people are always changing. Mm-hmm. And you need to have the veterans to sort of be the anchors mm-hmm. for that fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So I'd
because
like
nobody
to do
ever
that.
Writes anything down. So
oh, they do.
Oh, they do.
They have notebooks, and then the person who's reading them next is saying. But very often what's in the notebooks are kind of cryptic. You know, every year we try to make it clear.
I wonder if the preschool bazaar has changed much over the years.
It's bigger.
Bigger. It has more people from off island. It used to be strictly island people.
Well, but even with the that's not the real change I see. What I change is many of the artisans on the island. Mm-hmm. It used to be that the bazaar was it. There wasn't a farmer's market. There weren't all sorts of stores where people were selling their stuff. People didn't have the art studio along the road. So now you have much more of a saturation.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So, and it used to be when Nancy Bingham was at the Holiday Bazaar and she was doing her pottery, you know, the line was around the hall. Right?
That was the only time of the year you had a chance to buy from
pretty it. Much. I mean, I'm sure that Nancy would remember it differently, but that's how I remember it.
Interesting. Yeah.
So as the island economy has matured, the bazaar has changed in that sense, that there's still things that you only find there, like Barbara Jennings and Maribel, they're, you know, the placemats and the hot pads.
Uh-huh.
You know, bless their hearts.
Are they the ones who also make the doll clothing? Somebody makes doll clothing.
I think that's Dolores Foss, but actually, it could also be Barbara and Maribel, uh-huh. because I'm not really a doll clothing person, so I can't vouch for that.
Yeah. Winnie Alexander used to have all her sewn different things there, mm-hmm. you know.
Is that so? Her quilts? Was she
well,
a quilter?
Well, I don't mean quilts. Little things that you could buy, like mm-hmm. something to take your lunch in, or, you know, different hand-sewn mm-hmm. little items, which was smart, because there were a lot of people who wanted to buy little things, you know, and stocking stuffers, and, mm-hmm. you know. So it worked.
Well, a question comes to my mind here, Barbara, and that is, you know, have you also participated in other organizations on the island down through the years as a bookkeeper?
Oh, of course. Or I mean,
accountant?
I wouldn't call myself one of those people that is extremely active in the community. Compared to others, I am an amateur.
Okay.
But I do have the skill of being an accountant, which comes in handy. I'm still on the board of the Chamber of Commerce, for example.
Okay.
Dave Schwartz talked me into coming on the board a number of years ago. He was treasurer at the time, and he wanted me to be treasurer because they wanted him to be president.
Okay.
And the Chamber of Commerce at that point was as close as we had to any kind of local government, in the sense of they had just built the park in the village.
Okay.
And the Chamber of Commerce had taken on that project with the county and agreed to manage the park.
Okay.
So I considered it sort of my civic duty to be on the Chamber of Commerce. And, of course, now the joke at my house is that I'm treasurer for life.
Yeah. Is that a joke, Barbara?
Pretty much. I mean, if someone wants the treasurer's job, they just have to apply. But
yeah.
But I'm sort of, again, that's another job where I'm sort of an anchor mm-hmm. and a board that should be rotating. We need more volunteers for the chamber, guys. But over the years, that job has changed, because now we have the Tour de López, mm-hmm. which some people think is an intrusion. I don't really understand that myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, we have one weekend where we have a lot of people being introduced to López Island in a very pleasant, non-violent, a non-threatening way. And it provides the funding for the village park.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's a ripple effect for my mind, because it provides an exposure to the island by people who very possibly are going to come back or have fond memories, in the same way that John's family came to the island because of Henderson Camp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have that anymore. People don't come to the island because of Paul Allen. Yeah. So you have to have a source for that new blood. Mm-hmm. And if it's just random tourism, it works. But an event or some other thing that brings people here, you know, whether it's seminars or yoga classes, those kinds of things bring people here to be exposed to the what if of living on Lopez. And while people like to think that we don't need any more people, frankly, we're all dying off. We have to replace us. And we can't just do that internally. So new people will come, and that's not a bad thing. I also was involved with the library back in the early 80s. And I got talked into being on their board because, as you and Allie remember, my mother-in-law, Doris, was very active in the library. And so when I was approached to be on the library board, it was sort of a nostalgia thing. It wasn't really because I was an accountant. Mm-hmm. It was more of a nostalgia thing. Mm-hmm. And I was actually the president of the board, since that's the easiest job because you can delegate. And I was the president of the board in the years when we did the big expansion of the library back to where the fireplace is. I think there was a few people who didn't like that fireplace, but I think they've probably given up on that fight because I really like that fireplace.
I love it. Yeah.
And I hear they're talking about another expansion.
I've heard that too, out into the patio area. Is that what's going on?
That's what they're talking about. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know if it's going to happen, but every time I go there, there's more computer terminals.
Yeah. The place is busy. Didn't they just win another award? Didn't I read that in the paper?
They won another award. They're doing very well. Their circulation is extremely high.
And my circulation at the library is low in certain months and higher in other months. But the grind of tax season is something. But of course, some people think that I only work a few months out of the year because they don't understand what the accounting business is like. Okay. And I have a few weeks that are kind of carefree in the end of August. But right now, I just this week, I got the preliminary version of the 2010 tax software for my computer.
Now, is that a thrill for you, Barbara?
No, it's more of a dread. But, my business is very cyclical. It's just, there's always something in it. Now, you travel a lot. I know you have the medieval calendars that, what to do every day of the year. Well, as an accountant, I have my own medieval calendar. What to do every day of the year.
All right.
Well, one thing you have not mentioned, really, which I remember vividly, which is the fact that for years you were the main caregiver for Doris during the time that she could no longer take care of herself.
Yes, well, in our family, when we have a problem, we seem to react to it by building. Mm. So we added onto the house when we were having children. That was in 87. And then in 97, we added onto the house again. We really added onto the house and added a whole wing because Jack and Doris were approaching 90 and didn't want to leave the island, but were not really able to take care of themselves anymore. Because we discovered that Jack had learned to cook because Doris had forgotten. Mm. Yeah, dementia will do that. You forget things. Mm-hmm. So we borrowed some money, and they helped us pay it back, and we built a beautiful wing for them. And they moved in it must have been 97, and they had their own wing, kept the door closed whenever need be, and we had the door open otherwise, and Jack lived until the summer of 2000, and then he died rather suddenly of a heart attack. And that started putting even more burden on, well, not burden, but sort of continuous workload, shall we say, because, Doris didn't really understand what was going on. I mean, she was very happy and content, but she didn't understand what her brain had lost.
Right.
Yeah. So that was sort of a 24/7 job, and my office is in the middle of the house with Doris's wing on one side and our wing on the other, and so I was Actually, I always used to say that was the center of the spider web, and then years later I'd say, you know, I forgot that's where the food was. The spider lives on the outside and just comes to the center to attack. But being in the center really worked in those years when we were taking care of Doris. She lived to be 98.
That's right.
We have only about 20 seconds left.
And her best friends who came over daily were June Shearer Forrester, who passed on, and that nearly killed me to lose her as well as Doris, and Gail McCallum and Zane Hoyt. They came over as part of Lopez Hospice and would come every Tuesday and bring us lunch, and we had a party every Tuesday. And those are
lovely.
They were my extra mothers. I had five mothers all at the same time.
Thank you, Barbara, for a most delightful hour.
Well, I really enjoyed it, too. Thank you for asking me.
This is Ali Smilder saying goodbye until next month.